Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, December the 10th. On the show today, the latest in the Brexit negotiations from the Spectator's home team, plus Philip Ryecroft, former Permanent Secretary at the Department for Exiting the EU. Deal or no deal, what should Labour do about it? Political editor of The New Statesman, Stephen Bush, sheds light on Labour's renewed Brexit civil war. There's still no escaping COVID. Wales looks like it's about to go into a renewed lockdown. I'll speak to a former leader of the Welsh Conservatives to find out why infections there just aren't going down. And as the UK began vaccinating with the Pfizer jab this week, it's not the first country in the world to have started. China has already vaccinated 1 million of its people, but the vaccines haven't had regulatory approval. We'll speak to Cindy Yu, host of The Spectator's Chinese Whispers podcast, to find out what's going on. A reminder to subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, then you'll never miss a show on Spectator TV. Just hit the subscribe button in the bottom right corner. As always, a special thanks to Charles Stanley for supporting this week's episode of The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms and one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. So, first, Brexit. No point in speculating since nobody really knows, though the mood music has become increasingly downbeat this week. I'm joined by The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, and the deputy political editor, Katie Bowles. Welcome to you both. James, what do we now think happened at the Johnson-Van der Leyen dinner on Wednesday night in Brussels?
So I think over scallops and turbot, no coincidence there was quite so much fish served. I think the two sides set out their positions. But I don't think what happened over dinner was that they spotted any potential landing zones or compromises. So Michel Barnier and David Frost are going away to talk again until Sunday. But they are still trying to find solutions rather than trying to see how a solution could work in terms of legal text or the like. So we are still quite a way away, and they are still, I mean, the two sides are paradoxically very close, but also very far apart. Basically, everything is done apart from, I think, essentially two questions. One is this whole issue of the so-called ratchet clause. You know, what happens if the EU increases its standards and the UK doesn't follow suit? And fish. I think those two issues are the, you know, and they have been the issues for weeks now, but they are the two remaining issues. The question is, by Sunday, can they make progress on either of those? I think if they make any progress on either of those, I think that Johnson and von der Leyen will tell the negotiators to keep going. They'll try and give the talks another push, because I think that neither side wants to be the one who looks like they are responsible for no deal, for saying, right, that's it, the talks are done, over, there's no agreement.
So the real deadline in the end isn't all the ones that the media has been setting, or even the government in Britain and Brussels has implied. The real deadline in the end is midnight on the 31st of December.
Well, a few days earlier than that, because some legislation would need to go through both the European Parliament and the UK Parliament. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you are essentially correct that the only deadline now that matters is the end of a transition period and what can be done by then. And I think that you will see, I think there's also just the question is, can you get any momentum into these negotiations? And I think the question is, I think what some people hoped is that last night might create some fresh ways of thinking about these issues. It didn't do that, but there will be another Johnson von der Leyen conversation on Sunday.
James, the British have already said that when it comes to one of the sticking points are the rules, the regulations, the state subsidy regime. Now, the British have already said when it comes to rules and regulation, there'll be no regression, that what currently exists will be a base, and that we would not go back from that or resile from that. But the Europeans, as I understand it, are saying that's fine, but we also want what's called dynamic alignment. We want you to stay aligned with our rules as we change them through the 2020s and beyond. Do the Europeans, do they realize that if the British agreed to that position, there would be no real point in leaving the European Union?
Yeah, I think the issue is how do you manage that if the UK doesn't follow suit? And as you say, if the UK was simply going to do everything that the EU does, what would be the point in leaving it? So the question is, how do you manage that question? And I think at the moment, the EU wants a system where it could be judge and jury as to whether the UK was seeking to undercut the EU by not following these standards and impose punitive measures unilaterally. But what it also wants is the UK to sign up to not responding to those unilateral measures with measures of its own. So it is essentially trying to unilaterally disarm the UK, to get the UK to commit to unilateral disarmament ahead of any future trade war, and declare itself to be judge and jury in that dispute. Now, I think, in some ways, the inherent unreasonableness of that position suggests that there is some room for compromise here. What would, if you had a system of reciprocity where both sides could respond if they felt the other was behaving unfairly towards them, that's not the most stable basis for a relationship, but could that be the basis for an agreement and avoid the reality of tariffs from the 1st of January?
Katie, we're hearing the British Prime Minister setting up what's been called a no-deal unit. I thought they already had a no-deal unit, and Michael Gove was sort of in charge of it. What are they talking about?
Yes, so this is a further exploration in terms of a no-deal unit. So we have had Michael Gove leading all the no-deal preparations, these various committees, for months now. But this is now daily updates to the Prime Minister from a group of civil servants within 10 Downing Street on no-deal preparations. But it's actually part of a wider issue, a wider project, which is just winter and how bad winter is looking for the government. So you have the no deal updates, which is in case we do leave without a deal, and that is the case in January, but also combined and going along with that are general updates about the risks that the government is braced for in the new year, from everything from flooding to more issues of COVID, because the worry is that we've already seen how much pressure the state came under it in the first stage of the pandemic. There's a real concern that ultimately the system will not be able to cope if lots of things go wrong at once.
James, the EU has a summit today and tomorrow, starts today and continues into tomorrow. Will Brexit figure at all, or the inability to get any kind of breakthrough between the president of the European Commission and the British Prime Minister? Does that mean it doesn't figure at all, or will the British still be hoping? I mean, they've often indicated they want some kind of nation state intervention, by which I think in general they mean that Chancellor Merkel leans on President Macron not to be so intransigent on fish and so on. Is any of that likely to happen at this, or will Brexit be just the dog that doesn't bark at this summit?
Well, I think in an attempt to kind of preserve EU unity, they've been very keen to keep Brexit off the agenda. I think all there will be is an Ursula von der Leyen update on her conversation with Boris Johnson last night. I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the danger is that if last night had spied some potential compromises and Ursula von der Leyen had come and told the EU Council about them, that the French and the Belgians, who lead the kind of most hard line on both fish and level playing field, might have kind of shot them down straight away. I mean, the question is whether in the margins they're obviously going to be talking about this, whether you begin to get some movement. I also think that there might be some movement after this summit, because this summit on the European side has been dominated by this question about what to do about Hungary and Poland, what to do about sanctions on Turkey, and the whole issue of the EU's climate change targets. Once this summit is over, Angela Merkel is very methodical. She can kind of Brexit then becomes the last issue in the in tray of the German presidency of the EU Council, which she currently holds. So the question is, do you get some push then on those issues towards a compromise? And I think that the kind of question here is this: is the Commission have been very protective of their role in the negotiation. They basically kept saying to the Brits, "Don't speak to the nation states. We are your interlocutors in this negotiation." I think if that is the case, the Commission needs to be a bit more confident about saying to the nation states, right, this is, if you want a deal, this is the deal that can be done.
Okay. Katie, what is the constraint on the Prime Minister's side? What is it if he can, what is it that he concedes and then creates a whole mass of trouble for himself on the Tory backbenches. Well, what are they looking for to begin a rebellion?
Well, I think first things first, he is in a much stronger position than Theresa May of his party for several reasons, partly that majority of 80, but also just the fact that I think since he has become prime minister, even his Tory leadership campaign, his decision to resign as foreign secretary, there is a general sense of trusting the prime minister to a degree in terms of his natural instincts on Brexit, which Theresa May never had. That said, there are clearly some nervous Tory MPs, and there is the possibility that if he does bring back a Brexit deal, there will be a sizable rebellion. I still think it's unlikely it would stop anything from passing, but you could see that. And I think for the European Research Group, they put out a statement saying they, you know, supported the Prime Minister, but it was slightly menacing, I think, when it started talking about how there's nothing to fear from freedom, and a slight reminder of the red lines. For them, I think they will, Bill Cash will be studying the legal text very carefully, and I think that anything on sovereignty is going to be something that if they do not feel there's a clear enough cutaway, that is going to be a strong issue for them. Diverging is very key. I think though Boris Johnson does feel pretty strongly on that, but that's something they'll be looking at closely. And then I think that fisheries is an issue because ultimately you can, to a degree, fudge the language around some of this stuff. So arbitration and others, I think that there is a sense Boris Johnson, if he believes it is good, can get lots of MPs on side by telling them why he thinks that. Fisheries is much harder to fudge. I think that if you have a situation where we hear the figures in terms of the quota, in terms of the return catch, and they just sound quite measly, there's not much you can do to sugarcoat that. And I think that's why it's one of the hardest issues politically. And yes, you have the ERG, but on top of this, you have Red Wall MPs, some of whom I understand are talking about sending one of those letters to Boris Johnson saying, you know, do not surrender, stay on task. And also, particularly on fisheries, he has Scottish Tory MPs who are saying that ultimately they need something they can sell in Scotland. They need a tangible benefit. And it's really important that there is something which is clearly a win there. So I think that those are the two areas where you can start to see rebellion growing. As for no deal, I think there are a handful of One Nation MPs who would be very unhappy if that's where you got to. But I think you probably have more rebels on the other side if it's an unsatisfactory deal than if he goes for no deal. I think that is a smaller rebellion.
Are they all relishing the prospect of meeting on Boxing Day to ratify a deal?
It's definitely some nervous Tory MPs, particularly because recess dates have not yet been confirmed. But I think they're hoping that even traditionalists are hoping that perhaps the proxy technical voting system could come in useful there.
All right. James and Katie, for the moment, thank you very much. Let's go now to Philip Rycroft. He was Permanent Secretary of the Department of Exiting the EU. Philip, welcome to the Spectator TV. Was it always going to be this difficult?
Not necessarily. It's not surprising that it's been quite tough. It's an important relationship for both sides, probably the most important relationship, certainly on trade, but also on issues like internal security and so on. So there's a huge amount to play for. But of course, we have these big arguments of principle which are causing the blockage now. And that has been described already. On the one hand, the UK saying we left in order to be able to set our own rules. On the other side, the EU saying you want privileged access to our market, obligations come with that in the way that you manage your own regulatory environment.
But since this is now, even if we get a deal, it looks like it's going to be a pretty skinny deal. It's not going to be this Canada plus plus that we were talking about. It may not even be Canada. We've been calling it Canada Dry on this. If it is so skinny, why is the EU insisting that we remain aligned in so many ways with whatever the EU does?
Well, it is in contrast to being in the single market, it's a skinny deal. But as a trade deal, it would be one of the more advanced that the EU has done, particularly, of course, on tariff and quotas. That would be the big win. No tariffs and quotas for UK businesses trading with the EU and vice versa. And the EU side has said all along through this, and this isn't a new position, You're not like Canada. You're a lot closer. You do a lot more trade with us. And we are therefore commensurately more worried about you trading unfairly with us. That's the position they've taken. We have to remember that the single market is essentially the jewel in the EU crown, the legal construct that gives life and meaning to being a member of the EU, which is why they protect it so fiercely. The EU as a construct is designed to look after the interests of its own member states, not of third parties. And that's hence the caution in seeking to strike a deal with a close and important trading partner like the UK.
So when it came to the free trade deal with Canada, and although that was not entirely tariff-free or entirely quotas, it was a pretty, a lot of stuff, the tariffs came away and the quotas came away. It was a pretty decent, as free trade deals go, this was a pretty decent and extensive free trade deal. Yeah. But the EU did not insist that Canada's state subsidy regime had to fall in line with the EU, although there had to be dynamic alignment of Canada's rules and regulations with the EU. I think a lot of British people won't understand why you insist, yeah, well, we're closer, but so what? Most of our economy is services, and services are not geospecific. They won't understand why the British are being treated differently from the Canadians.
Sure, obviously that's been a big part of the arguments all the way through this, and the assumption on many people's part that the EU is being unreasonable. In a way, from the you looked at from where we are now a third country. We want this privileged access to their market. Of course, the EU is perfectly free, sovereign, if you like, to set the conditions for that. And I come back to the point, the concern, as I understand it, and I don't speak for the EU clearly, is because of the proximity, and proximity still matters in trade terms, and because of the volume of trade, that they worry about the UK stealing a march on EU-based businesses by allowing a different set of standards to emerge either side of the channel.
But the EU runs a massive trade surplus. Well, actually, it runs a current account surplus with the UK, but it particularly runs a massive trade surplus in traded goods with the UK. It would have to be one hell of a change in Britain's rules and regulations to dent that very much. I mean, this is not a straw man.
Well, I wonder, actually, from both sides of the this argument, whether in 3 or 4 years' time, particularly if we land up with no deal, we'll look back and think, what was all that fuss about? if you think about it, exactly your point, it would take some really big divergence in standards to have a material impact on trading conditions. But if you look at it from a UK perspective, the government's already said we accept non-regression, so we're not going to lower existing standards. And if you think on things like environment, the government dead keen to push on climate change. So improving standards is a good thing. And even if our standards are somewhat different from the EU's, when you roll forward 5, 10 years' time, it seems very likely that the EU and the UK will still be running similar levels of standards, because that's what developed, mature, civilized, modern economies will do. The one thing that stands out of that, of course, is state aid, where the UK has been very insistent on freedom to spend more money supporting businesses. Paradoxically, because it's always been the UK that has been the biggest proponent of control of state aid at the EU level. And France and Germany, within the rules, still spend a lot more money on state aid than the UK does. So one again has to question the motivations there. I mean, I speak as somebody who was a civil servant for 30 odd years, worked quite a lot on the business side of things. The state, at the end of the day, is generally not the best place to determine which are the winners in the future economy. In other words, the UK moving into a position where it wants to splash a lot of taxpayers' cash around on businesses, sort of shades of the 1970s and British Leyland there. And I wonder again, in 3 or 4 years' time, will people look back and say, You know, wasn't that a bit of a red herring, to coin another phrase? So that fisheries, I think we can sort out, by the way.
I never thought I would see a stumbling block for a Tory government to be the right to dole out lots of state aid.
Exactly.
But have these talks from the start, Philip, been characterized by a certain mutual incomprehension?
Yes, and I think also a lack of trust. And I think that lack of trust has been there all the way through, but was exacerbated, of course, by the UK Internal Market Bill. Happily now those clauses that offended the EU and indeed other international partners have now been withdrawn. But I think there has been this mutual incomprehension on the EU side, what has driven Brexit, and from the UK side, a misunderstanding of how the EU operates and where the deep concerns of the EU lie. And that's just not been very helpful throughout all of this. And is perhaps a signal also of the way in which the UK, through our membership, never really got sort of integrated into understanding the operation of the EU in a way that's second nature to the countries that are more core to that enterprise.
If we were to leave on no deal, in your view, would there then quite quickly, and by that I mean sometime next year, maybe after the summer, would there be a move then to try and reopen the talks and do a free trade deal again, try and get that done? Or would relations actually, both sides may be so angry that relations could end up in the freezer for quite some time?
Yeah, three quick things to say about that. One is that the EU and the UK will have to talk about stuff from here on forever, whether we like it or not, including fisheries, common resource. The fish don't respect the median line. They don't get spawned as a British or a French fish. The stocks move around. You have to manage these resources in common. And there'll be loads of other stuff where we have to talk. Second point, this relationship is too important, both on trade and on internal security and on a bunch of other things, not to formalise the relationship at some point. But third point, I agree with you when you say that the risk is, if we have no deal at the end of this year, tempers will be such and political pride will be such that neither side will be willing to be the one that says, oh, we need to get first, we need to get back round the table. So it could be some time before negotiations resume to put the relationship on a sound footing.
When you stand back a little bit from trying to work out whether we're going to get a deal or no deal and get away from the incredible detail that goes into these talks, whether you were for Remain or whether you were for Leave, when you look at how close the EU and the UK, how many areas we will need to cooperate in the 2020s and beyond, our common interests as well, in or out of the EU, you know, it's our biggest market. We have a common interest in the Eurozone doing well, whether we're in the EU or not, in defense and security and intelligence, and I mean, just standing up for democracy and human rights. We have so much in common. We are free traders. You know, we don't want tariffs if we can. Is it, if we don't get a deal, is it not really depressing that two sides with so much in common just couldn't do a bloody trade deal?
Yes, and actually a failure of statecraft on both sides after four and a bit years not to be able to manage that. And let's not, even though the deal that's on the table, as you described it earlier, is quite a thin deal, no deal is damaging. It's economically damaging for both sides. The application of tariffs in terms of automotives, agri-food and so on, even for fisheries, is very damaging. All the other agreements fall away, like on internal security, on research and all the rest of it. Even Australia, I know that people talk about Australia as the no deal destination, even Australia has a number of deals with the EU. We would only have one, the withdrawal agreement. If you think about short-term disruption at the border in a no-deal world, what is the incentive on the part of the EU authorities or the French authorities, the Belgian authorities to play nice? But just one final thought on this, which is, I think, hugely important for the UK. We've got some really rather important elections coming up next year in Scotland and Wales. And we know where opinion is at in Scotland on the question of independence. We know that Brexit and feeling about Brexit in Scotland has been a bit of a driver for that. A no deal Brexit, it seems to me, exacerbates concern within the UK Union about our future direction as a country. And somebody lives in Scotland and a lot of work in Scotland, that worries me immensely.
Well, you used to work in government in Scotland, so let's finish on Scotland, because if you look at what it's taken, and we're not there yet, to unravel a 50-year arrangement, which wasn't, despite what a lot of the Brexiteers said, in many areas wasn't that deep. I mean, what is it? And we're still 4 years out, and we've still not left yet or even come to a deal. If Scotland was to vote for independence in a second referendum, I mean, the mind boggles at what these negotiations would require, unraveling 300 years of union and countries, economies, cultures, peoples who have been totally integrated every way you think. I mean, they're not going to happen very quickly either.
No, in a word, I absolutely agree with that. And we sort of peered over that cliff edge back in 2014 when the referendum on Scottish independence came quite close. Of course, notoriously, the Prime Minister of the day, David Cameron, didn't allow us within Whitehall to do any contingency planning for that eventuality. But what I can say is behind the scenes, particularly after that famous Sunday Times poll that put the yes side ahead, there was a bit of scurrying around in the corridors of Whitehall to think, how on earth do we cope literally on day one of that result? But you're absolutely right. We did a huge amount of work describing the benefits of the UK Union for all parts of the Union. We had about 14 or 15 tomes from everything from defence through to the social security system, to culture, to movement of people and so on. Dismantling all of that would be an absolutely huge challenge and would be for the British state, for the remainder UK, would be a distraction from everything else that we wish to do for years. When Brexit happened, of course, again, we didn't do a lot of contingency planning for that either. But we know from the experience there just what a massive task that was, which started the day after the referendum and is far from finished now. But Scottish independence would make all of that pale in comparison.
Well, Ryecroft, with that thought, the mind boggles. We'll leave it there. We thank you for your time and expertise being on Spectator TV. And we wish you a very Merry Christmas.
And you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Philip Ryecroft there. Now, before we move on, I'd just like to remind you to subscribe to the Spectator's YouTube channel. It's free. You'll never miss a new episode of Spectator TV because it will alert you when one is coming up. You just hit the subscribe button in the bottom right corner. Now, we stick with Brexit, but from a different angle. If there is a deal, it will need to be ratified on both sides of the channel. There are mechanisms ready to do that. On our side, it will be ratified or needs to be by the Commons. So if a deal comes before Parliament, what should Labour do? Who better to update us on this and Labour's renewed Brexit strife, it would seem, than Stephen Bush, political editor of The New Statesman. Stephen, before we get into some of the detail here, just broadly describe what there seems to be some kind of dividing line on this, even within the shadow cabinet.
Right, so within the shadow cabinet, there are essentially two schools of thought. The thing that they all agree on is that because they do not believe, they think no deal would be an utter disaster. You can't gamble with the possibility that you cause it by mistake if the Conservative rebellion is above expectation. So they know that voting against it is off the table. But within the shadow cabinet, you have a sort of coalition of people who opposed Brexit despite being in very Leave seats, who have therefore taken a lot of political risk and are quite attached to that position, who go, well, we can't vote for this very thin deal. We're miles away from what we had before. We have to abstain. And then you have long-term committed opponents of Brexit who feel the same way. Then you have, and I think it's fair to say, a tendency which is more naturally inclined to Keir Starmer's position. So people who came to that second referendum position fairly late on in 2018, early in 2019, partly when it became clear that Labour could no longer ride two horses, who, to be honest, sort of just want to be able to get rid on this issue. They want to be able to send a clear signal that they are not going to unpick Brexit, and what clearer signal than to vote for it. And of course, the excuse, which is, you know, a legitimate excuse, but the excuse is the risk of no deal. And that's where the cabinet are.
And I can see that, but I mean, even almost just for the sake of a quiet life and to get it out of the way, would it not be a defensible position for Keir Starmer to say, look, we were against leaving the European Union, but we know that argument is over. However, we're not voting for a deal because we don't even like this deal much. We're not going to unpick it. We're not going to try and relitigate the referendum again, but we're just going to abstain. This is the government's deal. It's the government. They were the ones that wanted Brexit. We are not going to vote for it. We're not going to vote against it. It's their deal, and it's not really our issue. Is that not a defensible position?
I think in a vacuum, it's a defensible position. I think the problem that Labour has sort of made for itself is that under Keir Starmer, they've abstained on a number of bills that are tricky for their internal coalition. So they abstain on a series of bills to do with increasing the power of the security services and changing how they're overseen. And I think that the problem that Labour now have is that actually the argument you describe is impeccable in a vacuum. But I think we're at a stage where it's quite likely that people would go, don't you abstain on everything difficult? When are you ever going to get off the fence? And I think that's why it becomes a bit harder and a bit more fraught for Labour to abstain on this one.
The problem, though, for Keir Starmer, too, if he is intending to go down that road, is that when it comes to, they'll be voting on what is essentially an international treaty. So I think I'm right, Stephen, saying it's all or nothing. They can't put amendments down to say, you know, oh, you should change the fish quota, or we should have more power over state subsidies. I mean, you either take it all or you have to vote against it. Is that correct?
Well, the actual difficulty is the treaty itself doesn't need to pass through Parliament, only the implementing legislation. And the reason why that's so difficult for Labour is if the implementing legislation is, here is our arbitration mechanism, well, Labour is pro having an arbitration mechanism and would sign up to less regulatory autonomy than the Conservatives will get if there is a deal, because they would trade that for more market access. But what if the implementing legislation is, here's a huge bunch of powers for the Prime Minister, for the Executive, taken away from Parliament to implement not just this trade deal, but every trade deal? Well, that's quite painful for the Labour Party to vote for that. So this is why the precise detail may make this issue more fraught for Labour. It's one thing to say we'll support a deal, quite another to support a swathe of Henry VIII powers.
No, exactly. Now, okay, so let's look at the shadow cabinet situation, then the parliamentary party, and then, insofar as we can tell, the party in the country. How does the shadow cabinet divide on this, and who are the major figures on either side?
All right, so the majority of the shadow cabinet is in the kind of get on to get along position on this. You know, just vote for it, make the issue go away. If it all goes wrong, no one remembers what Labour's position on the ERM was. No one remembers what George Osborne's position on the 2006 budget round was, right? Then there's a group of people who are actually very well represented, particularly in the shadow treasury team. So both the shadow chief secretary of the treasury, Bridget Phillipson, who sits for a very Leave constituency, and the shadow chancellor, Annalise Dodds, who sits for a very Remain constituency, are of the view that, look, this deal doesn't work. We would probably want to revisit it to get more, to get a greater level of market access, because obviously that underpins their ability to spend more money on the public services. So let's not put our hands on it. Then you have people like David Lammy, who are long-term, very committed opponents of Brexit, who are also very reluctant to back it. But crucially, Rachel Reeves, who is his de facto shadow Brexit secretary, who, like Keir Starmer, someone who was against stopping Brexit for quite a long time, then in 2018 kind of went, OK, we're clearly stuck. Let's go with the sort of vote maximisation approach for Labour, because obviously more of their core vote was Remain than Leave, and still is Remain than Leave. But those are the kind of key participants, with Keir Starmer having to act as the decider within the cabinet.
And on the back benches, on the Labour back benches, Stephen, Is there a risk of a real divide here, that the party could be really, if not split down the middle, nevertheless, a big chunk of rebels could defy Mr. Starmer?
No, I don't think there's all that much chance. The where this kind of gets complicated from a Labour perspective is obviously Keir Starmer has suspended Jeremy Corbyn from the parliamentary party because of his reaction to the EHRC report. And that has triggered a bunch of tit-for-tat reprisals within the Labour Party on its left-right axis. And so if Keir Starmer votes to, however he whips, whether it's abstain or to vote for, a number of people on the Labour left are going to vote against the deal. And I think that means you probably end up with a rebellion in 30-40s. Now, I don't think that will be a particularly significant event in the life of the Labour Party. And if I were advising the left of the Labour Party, I would say, don't do it. You have no credibility on this issue, right? No one thinks, oh, do you know who really loves being a member of the EU? The Benite left, right? It just looks a bit incoherent. And so most of the rebellion will, I think, be able to be sort of passed aside as that kind of thing. The crucial thing is the group of people in the Labour Party who really mattered in terms of their Brexit position last time were people who were frightened of a Liberal Democrat revival. And bluntly, it doesn't look like that is going to be a factor at the moment. But it's really if those people, so people who don't have particularly strong EU convictions, but they do have a lot of students in their seat, fairly leafy parts and used to vote Lib Dem. If those people start to go, oh, I don't like how this is going, I don't like my mailbag, that's when you'd see a big and disfiguring Labour rebellion.
Let me bring James Forsyth in here, who's been listening to us, Stephen. James, what's your take on Labour's dilemma?
I think what Keir Starmer said at Prime Minister's Questions when he strongly indicated that Labour would back the deal is actually the only thing for Labour to do, because you've got to vote on what's in front of you, and the alternative to this deal would be no deal, which Starmer is on the record as saying that. And also, I think Stephen is right. No one will remember that Labour backed it. This is going to be Boris Johnson's deal, whatever happens. But if he votes against it, he sets himself up for years of Boris Johnson attacks, of he still wants to stop Brexit, he still hasn't come to terms with it. And I thought the most striking thing about PMQs yesterday was how visibly uncomfortable Keir Starmer was talking about Brexit. Normally at Prime Minister's Questions, Boris Johnson looks a bit like, oh crikey, I've got 6 difficult questions from this lawyer. Yesterday he was on much more ebullient form because the subject was Brexit and he knows how uncomfortable Starmer is on that issue. So I think Keir Starmer, you know, the best thing to do is to just try and kind of, as Stephen put it, get rid. So vote for the deal and the legislation to put it into law, and just hope that you can kind of, but the next election isn't going to be fought on the whole Brexit question again. And also, I think kind of Stephen is right as well, which is, you know, yes, there are some members of the Shadow Cabinet, the Parliamentary Labour Party, who are worried about kind of a pro-Remain backlash in their seats. But realistically, Labour are not going to lose many seats to the Lib Dems or the Greens at the next election in 2023 or 2024 on which way they voted on a Brexit deal. While as if there is a deal and they vote against it, that could be used to hammer them again in those red wall seats that they lost last time round.
I'll come back to Stephen to finish up and get reaction to that. But before I do, let me go to Katie. Now, Katie, what are you hearing about the mood on the Labour side and the Shadow Cabinet and on the Labour backbenches?
Well, I think, as Stephen has explained very clearly, there is that divide. I think another thing in terms of concern over what Keir Starmer chooses is I have had some Labour MPs say to me that they worry there is a pattern at the moment of a Labour Party that just abstains. And often the position in votes, and we've seen that with lockdown votes, is to abstain. And therefore, this is an issue of the day. So I think there is more of a pressure to take a strong position. But they worry about a pattern by which you have a Labour leader who, yes, is doing well in the polls, but quite quickly could develop a reputation as someone who doesn't really have strong stances or, you know, chooses things depending on what's the most, you know, politically easy. And I think there is a concern at the moment that you can understand it in terms of the first year Keir Starmer has faced. There's been a lot changing. He hasn't had to do that much policy. But I think that what I have heard from some Labour MPs who don't think they will like the deal, is that they don't think it is sustainable for Starmer to keep abstaining on votes. And this is such a big one that were he to choose to do that, it would fit a pattern which could be quite unfavourable to them.
Stephen, final question to you, and just picking up on the points there, and please respond to them. I mean, would it be too simple to simply to bring it down to this if you were Keir Starmer? You would think, Look, if we need to win back some of these red wall seats if we're to have any chance of even being the largest party. If we vote against this deal or even abstain, the Tories will just throw this at us relentlessly and make it more difficult to get these red wall seats back. They'll say we can't be trusted. So let's just hold our nose and vote for it and then move on. Stephen.
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I think it comes back to James's excellent summary of yesterday's PMQs, right? Which, you know, PMQs itself doesn't matter. But what it does do is it reveals where the parties are comfortable and where they're vulnerable. And broadly, if the next election can be about Brexit in any way, that's painful for Labour, and I think probably fatally painful for Labour. It's just impossible to see how they get back into office if Brexit is a live question. So therefore, from a tactical perspective, I think this is open and shut for Keir Starmer. But I also actually think it's open and shut from a statesmanship perspective, right? I don't think that responsible parties roll the dice with economic shocks, right? And ultimately, if you vote against a new Labour Party, you're rolling the dice with an economic shock. So I actually think it is one of the things where both the politics and the policy are aligned. And obviously, that is divisive in the Labour Party, and there are many reasons why the Labour Party does not call my advice.
But we have called for your advice today, and we're glad we did. Stephen Bush of The New Statesman, a pleasure to have you on Spectator TV. Thank you for your time and your expertise, and we wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Now, before we move on to the next segment of the show, this is one more reminder to subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free. Then you'll never miss a new episode of Spectator TV because you'll get an alert. Just hit the subscribe button in the bottom right corner of the YouTube screen. Now, COVID, no getting away from it. At the end of October, Wales went into a two-week lockdown, what it dubbed a firebreak. At the time, First Minister Mark Drakeford celebrated its success, posting that the seven-day incidence rate had almost halved. But just a month after the firebreak ended, Wales is in a critical situation once again. At the end of November, it was the only part of the UK where infection rates were not falling. Now there's more talk of another lockdown, perhaps even Christmas being cancelled in the Principality. So, did the firebreak work or not? I'm joined by a sceptic, Welsh Conservative politician Andrew R.T. Davis. He's also Wales' shadow health minister. Andrew Davis, welcome to Spectator TV. First of all, give us an overview of the COVID situation in Wales right now. How serious is it?
Good afternoon, Andrew. Well, it's pretty bleak to say the least, and it cheers me no end to actually be sitting here and ultimately being able to paint the picture, because ultimately what's happened over the last 3 to 4 weeks is Wales has been marginalised on the basis that everyone's focused on the English lockdown, when in fact the measures that the Welsh Government have put in place to try and combat COVID over the last 3 months have been nothing far short of disastrous. We've got high infection rates, some villages and towns with an infection rate of over 1,500 per 100,000 cases. That, by any estimation, is massive. And regrettably, we now have this grim statistics of having the highest death count in the UK, as well as the highest infection rate. So on all counts, the Welsh Government have got a pretty grim record on all this.
So in your view, I'll come back to the firebreak in a minute and its efficacy or not. But in your view overall, what has gone wrong?
Well, I think the issue's been that they've changed the messaging so many times through the autumn. Originally, we had a council area-based restriction policy here in Wales. Then we moved into the firebreak lockdown. Then we also had restrictions between travel between England and Wales. Then when we came out of the firebreak lockdown, there was unlimited travel across the whole of Wales, whether you were in a high infection rate or low infection rate. And then there was talk about possible potential third lockdowns. And now we have the hospitality industry shut down here in Wales. And the public have just got so confused with the messaging from the government, from a strong position that they had in the summer, which I'm perfectly willing to pay credit to the Welsh government, but they did have a good record to talk about back in the summer. They've really thrown that away through the autumn months and now look pretty discredited in the eyes of the public.
We're going to put a chart up on the screen on daily COVID cases in Wales. It starts in September and takes us up to roughly now, more like the end of November, to be more accurate. And within that, you see the firebreak coming in, and that's marked from around the 25th of November to the 8th of December. And what it shows is that cases were rising pretty fast, from well under 100 to over 1,200. The fire break comes in, and the cases do fall. They don't fall back to where they were, but they fall quite rapidly. The fire break ends, and the cases start to rise again. And as of this chart at the end of November, they're still rising. Now, many people looking at that chart will say, well, the problem is the so-called fire break, the lockdown, wasn't long enough. What do you say?
Well, I disagree, because the fire break or lockdown is no solution to the problem we find ourselves in. And we did put an alternative plan forward for what we believe would have been appropriate at the time. So rather than just being in a position of opposition to say you're doing it wrong and offer no alternative, the issue is that many statisticians point to the infection rate actually dropping before the fire break came in, from infection rates from about the end of October. And it takes about a 14-day period for that to feed through. But what we have are the contradictory messages. That's the real fault line throughout this, because the public in Wales generally do want to get on top of this virus, suppress it. But as I've highlighted, the messaging throughout the whole of the autumn, whether it be the fire break, whether it be the travel restrictions, whether it be the closure of the hospitality industry, have confused the public here in Wales. And with that confusion, people have just decided to go about their business in the way that they see fit, and have lost faith in the government. And regrettably, some communities have been blighted more than other communities, such as the numbers are holding up to show at the moment.
And I should just clarify, I got my months wrong there. The fire break came in on the 25th of October, as you, or around then, as you referred to as October, and then came off around the 8th of November. So it straddled the end of October and the beginning of November, not November into December, as I said. Well, as we look at the picture now, Andrew Davis, the graph is still rising, and the number of cases is rising too. So what is to be, if the fire break in your view was not the right way, what is to be done now with Christmas bearing down on us?
Well, win back the public's confidence is a key part of what needs to be addressed here, because the public confidence is draining away from the government message. And I do believe that if that public confidence can be won back and they start buying back into the messages that will contain the virus, we can at least get to Christmas and the other side of Christmas. The real risk, as all commentators in any part of the United Kingdom are talking about, is what happens in January and February. And that is the unknown here. And I would defer to medical and scientific opinion here. But it is my opinion that obviously people have got greater confidence in the future because of the vaccine programme that's been announced, that we, like all parts of the United Kingdom, have been undertaking vaccinations this week. And that will escalate as time goes on. But it is down to the confidence that the public have in the government. And we know that fire breaks and lockdowns do not actually beat the virus in themselves. It's the measures that go in tandem with that. And when you look at the travel restrictions that have been put in place by the Welsh Government, for example, today in Wales, you cannot enter a hospitality establishment and have a drink. Yet you can jump in a car and drive into an English Tier 1 or Tier 2 area, have a drink in a pub and drive back to Wales. That is the foolishness of the government's messaging. And that's what's draining the confidence away from the public when they look at what's been asked of them by the government ministers on their daily press conferences.
Is there increasingly to a compliance issue? I mean, I see the Welsh police have dealt with 1,000 COVID-related incidents since the fire break. Some reports in the Welsh press that compliance is at an all-time low. Indication of that is the infection rate growing the most quickly for the under 25s. Now, compliance is an issue for the whole of the United Kingdom, but is it particularly an issue in Wales?
It's a growing issue because, again, it goes back to that confidence that you might have or not in the government and the way the government is handling things. And if you go into any town or city or village across Wales today, you will see people going about their business, many having regard for the regulations, but regrettably an increasing larger minority who are, if you like, reverting back to old habits. And that in itself is causing problems, as we know is feeding through into the health service here in Wales. But I go back to my fundamental argument as an opposition politician here in Wales, that whilst the Welsh Government did a good job through the summer months, they've thrown that credit away through the autumn with the mixed messaging and the complete lack of bearing down on the virus on a local basis that has has led to the situation we find ourselves in today, which is the highest death rate in the United Kingdom, the highest infection rate in the United Kingdom, and a pretty grim trajectory of the virus spreading across communities in Wales.
What would you say to someone like the Swansea-based Director of Public Health, Keith Reid? He says that unless you lock down, the health system there will be overwhelmed.
Well, and he's speaking from a position where his health board, in the announcement at the beginning of the week, was talking of at least 700 members of staff being away absent because of sickness and ill health. We know this is a pressure point for the health service here in Wales. I personally am sceptical about lockdowns and fire breaks if they're dealt with just in isolation, because they do not deal with the fundamentals of the virus spreading within the community. And it goes back to this argument that I keep projecting, is about building that confidence back in the community. Because we know in the last fire break, regrettably, people moved their hospitality activities into domestic settings. And that is the most highly infectious point that has been pointed out by many scientists and epidemiologists as the breakdown of the virus, because it spreads because people lose their discipline in that domestic setting. And so I do re-emphasise, I understand the points that the public health and people working in the NHS are bearing down with at the moment. But the reality is the government in Wales have lost control of the virus. The health minister has lost the confidence, I would suggest, of many people in Wales, along with the First Minister, as was seen yesterday in comments about blaming the people of Wales for the spread of the virus, rather than looking in the mirror and maybe asking some searching questions of themselves. And when you start blaming the people, i.e. your customers, you are on a slippery slope.
And just finally, given the trajectory of COVID cases and many of the difficulties that you yourself have alluded to, you say even that it's almost lost control in some areas, is there not a risk then that the Welsh Government may feel it necessary, in effect, to cancel Christmas?
Well, it's been alluded to both by the Health Minister and the Chief Medical Officer about more restrictions and contingency planning at this side of Christmas, although the First Minister himself in our session of First Minister's Questions ruled that out on Tuesday. And if you like, that goes to the heart again of the point I've been making right the way through this interview about the mixed messaging that's coming out of government at the moment. You have the First Minister saying there's no chance of more restrictions this side of Christmas, yet you have the Health Minister in his press conference on Monday, along with the Chief Medical Officer yesterday, talking about the potential need for greater restrictions. We can all see the rising numbers, and we all want to get on top of this virus and suppress the virus, because in its worst form, regrettably, it leads to death. And we all know the consequences of long COVID as well. So there are no easy solutions here. But what's got to be done here is that confidence rebuilt with people the length and breadth of Wales, so that we can feel that we can get through this winter and be in a better place in the spring next year with the vaccination programme.
Andrew Artie-Davies, Shadow Health Minister in Wales, thank you for joining us on Spectator TV today, and a Merry Christmas to you.
Same to you. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Now, we stick with COVID and, of course, with vaccines. Tuesday was heralded as V-Day for the UK when the rollout of the Pfizer vaccine started. Kate Andrews is our economics correspondent. She edits the Spectator's daily COVID-19 update email. It is one of the biggest COVID newsletters in the world. She joins me now. Kate, talk us through where we are with the vaccine in Britain. Now, I saw the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, get quite emotional about it. He clearly thought this was a turning point.
Yes, he got teary on Breakfast TV talking about this turning point. And it is a turning point, Andrew. I think we can definitively say that every day now we are taking steps to be closer to protecting the vulnerable in the UK. Margaret Keenan was the first person to get the Pfizer jab on Tuesday. She's turning 91 years old next week. This is one jab of 800,000 that are meant to be administered in the coming weeks. That's 400,000 people that are going to be inoculated. And this jab from Pfizer is thought to be effectively 95% effective. So I think it's safe to say that we are getting a lot closer to protecting our vulnerable, but there's still a lot of outstanding questions as to the timeline, how many vaccines the UK is actually going to procure, how many more are going to come online, and how we continue to learn to live with this virus, because we're far away from saying that everybody is safe.
How seriously do we take these reports of two NHS workers had a quite severe reactions to the Pfizer vaccine. Is that just, that's what happens, there are a few who do, or is it more serious than that?
Well, when Pfizer was running its safety tests, they did find that roughly 1 in 1,000 people might have had an allergic reaction. This is something that can happen with all kinds of vaccinations, including the flu jab. There are warnings about allergic reactions. I think the concern around this one, it's two NHS workers who had an allergic reaction. They're now thought to be recovering. It was a short-term reaction. It was by no means fatal. But the concern is that the UK regulator has now updated the guidance after people started to receive the jab. And I think it goes to this broader point of how officials need to be really honest and transparent and communicative about the data and the safety around this vaccine. Polls across the UK show that certainly over 50% of the UK residents plan to take this vaccine, 60%, 70%, depending on which poll you're looking at. And that's pretty good data. And for those who are skeptical, it's usually not because they actually have anti-vaxxer opinions, but they just want to know more about the safety. So I think, you know, incidents like this speak to the fact that officials really need to get out there and communicate about why these jabs are safe, the slight risks that can be involved. But there's a great piece on the Spectator website right now from Dr. Mark Toshner talking about how the risks are extremely low and why it's a good idea to get this vaccine.
Right. Well, that's worth reading. Kate, bring us up to date now on the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. The United Kingdom has bought already 100 million doses, a lot more than it bought on the Pfizer one. Where are we with that? When do we think that can be rolled out?
So if the Oxford vaccine were to come online, we would more or less have enough doses of this vaccine to go around, certainly to protect the vulnerable and those in older age groups. It's where the UK has invested most when it comes to these jabs, but it's becoming increasingly complex. When Oxford first reported on its efficiency rate, it said it was roughly 70% effective, but we found out when that number was broken down that it was 62% effective for the large cohort that had a certain kind of dose given, and then it was 90% effective if the jabs were given in different doses. And so now there are questions, and The Lancet has done a big report this week as to what a UK regulator can actually approve. Some of the questions are around age. Perhaps they might approve it for the under 55s. The 90% efficiency rate was only tested on those under 55s. It's thought that they may need to go back into a phase 3 trial. But The Lancet highlights that if this vaccine were to be between 60 to 80% effective, its authors think that you would still need certain kinds of social distancing measures, ones that we know the Prime Minister and I'm sure many people, perhaps the vast majority in the UK, would really like to throw out the window as soon as possible. The idea of a vaccine is that it is supposed to be a silver bullet. So one that isn't a silver bullet is not going to be looked as favorably on. So there's still a lot of outstanding questions around Oxford. If and when it comes online, it will be a game changer, as I said, because hopefully we could really speed up that timeline for getting this vaccine out there and injecting lots of people. But if it doesn't come online for a while, it does slow down the process. The UK has invested in the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, which hopefully comes online soon. But by and large, it's really relying on Oxford.
And finally, Kate, the economics of all this, we got the latest UK GDP figures today, showed the economy growing for the sixth consecutive month, but it also showed that growth was beginning to peter out by October, nothing like the growth, the bounce back after the horrendous fall in the economy in March and April. It would seem, looking at these figures, that although the economy may have been a bit more resilient than some might have thought, it could now be stagnating through November into December, and that we need, really need the rollout of these vaccines early in the new year if we're to see life back in the economy again by Easter, early summer. Is that correct?
I fear it could be worse than that, Andrew. We saw the economy start to stall in its progress in August, which was arguably the most open month of the year when it comes to COVID restrictions, the ability to socialize and for shops to be open. And one of the reasons it's stagnating is because we've learned that if certain restrictions are in place, there's only so much that an economy can really recover. But I think it's going to do worse than stagnate. It's very likely that when we get November's figures, we're going to see another economic contraction, albeit not nearly as big as what we saw in April, but England's second lockdown and the forced reclosure of shops and non-essential business is bound to have a bad impact on the economy. Now, a lot of these forecasters say the good news is that if vaccines come online, if we are inoculating millions of people in the UK by next spring, we could be in a much better position rolling back those social distancing measures. And some forecasters have suggested we should look to their optimistic scenarios now, not their central scenarios, which usually on average show the UK economy recovering by early 2022, as opposed to the end of 2022. And that is a big and meaningful difference, but it is going to require a lot to happen with vaccines in a relatively short period of time. And I think when we look at the trajectory of 2020, because we know the vaccine's not going to have that impact this year, you're going to see not a V-shaped recovery, not a Nike-shaped recovery, but actually quite a wonky W, because we are likely to have that second economic contraction.
I'm just going to contemplate a wonky W. Kate Han.
Doesn't look good.
Economic correspondent for The Spectator. Thank you for being with us on Spectator TV today. Now, China has been vaccinating its population with unapproved vaccines since July. The estimate is that 1 million people have been vaccinated. None of these jabs have received regulatory approval. It may be why state media has been relatively hush-hush about this vaccination program. Cindy Yu is The Spectator's broadcast editor. She's host of our Chinese Whispers podcast, which if you want to know what is happening in China, is a must listen. And she writes about the vaccination program on our Coffee House website this week. Cindy, welcome to Spectator TV. Just tell us a little bit about what's been happening then. I mean, 1 million people is not a lot in a country the size of China. Nobody's really talked about it. What kind of vaccine is it? Why 1 million? Who's doing it? What do we know?
So, Andrew, starting from the beginning, as you said, this started in July. That was when China introduced this legislative loophole based on WHO emergency response to Ebola outbreak, which was basically saying, you know, in an emergency situation, you can vaccinate frontline health workers, frontline transport workers, and so on. What the new legislation has said in China, though, is that if you're going abroad to high-risk countries, you can also get the vaccine. So what that means is that the top producers of vaccines in China, there are three of them, Sinopharm, which is a state-owned company, Sinovac, which is a private company, and CanSino, which is a military-developed one. Since July, they've been injecting people. So Sinopharm has been injecting its own company employees. Some of them are Huawei employees as well, who go abroad, do these foreign contracts in different countries, and then some of them have even come back and got into trouble with border control in Shanghai because they had antibodies that they were detected. And so CanSino has been injecting soldiers. We don't know much about the injections of these two companies because they've been keeping relatively quiet about who they're injecting and how many, although Sinopharm claims to have injected nearly 1 million people. What I've been looking at in particular is Sinovac vaccination. They've been doing this in Zhejiang province, which has 57 million people. So as you say, 1 million is a drop in the ocean for that. And the requirement there is to go abroad or if you're one of these frontline workers. What has happened is that on social media, this has caused something of a millennial furore because all people 20-somethings who study abroad, something of a rite of passage for young Chinese people these days, they're all clamouring for the vaccine. And in most of Zhejiang province, you have to be a local resident in order to get the vaccine. But in this one tiny city of 1 million people, Yiwu, you can get the vaccine as long as you provide plane ticket, some kind of proof that you're going abroad. And so on social media, everyone's recommending Yiwu as a place to go. How do you get on the waiting list? How much does it cost? And all that sort of stuff, because they're not getting much guidance from state media, because as you say, national state media really hasn't touched it at all. You'd think that this would be something that Global Times, the very jingoistic nationalist tabloid paper, would be having a field day on, that China started vaccinating so early. But they haven't. And I think the reason for that is because these vaccines are in phase three trials. The only reason they're allowed to be rolled out is because they count as emergency vaccinations.
Two questions, Cindy. Is there any evidence of untoward reactions to this vaccine? I mean, do we have any idea how this vaccine has performed, even though it hasn't finished its full trial yet? And if the Chinese authorities do have confidence in it, despite the trials not yet being completed, why only 1 million people?
I think those are good questions, Andrew. So on the first one, the UAE, which is one of the first countries in the world to be rolling out Sinopharm's vaccine, has said that it's 86% effective, but none of the data has been released, and that was only yesterday. So we there's no, you know, peer review for that. There's no verification process for that. They claim that no one has had adverse reactions. But one student I spoke to, one 20-something-year-old who studies in London but is in Beijing, when he got vaccinated, he didn't leave contact details. They haven't contacted him since. So I don't know how these companies would know if anyone did have an adverse reaction, because they're not tracking it as far as I can see. I guess if you're more systematically getting it because it's a place of work, then there might be more of a route there, more of a mechanism. And, you know, I think that China hasn't wanted to do a mass rollout because it wants to see how this vaccine goes. China doesn't have a great track record when it comes to food and drug safety. Viewers might have heard of the 2008 milk powder scandal where melamine-infused baby formula hospitalized tens of thousands of babies. So since then, China has done a lot of work on finessing that system. But it was only 2 years ago when another vaccine manufacturer, not any of the ones involved here, was fined over $1 billion for putting out faulty rabies vaccines. So China doesn't have a great record on it. I think if I was Xi Jinping right now, I wouldn't necessarily want to put my face on these vaccines before they're approved. And so that's probably why it's only had 1 million people. It's only rolling out in one province so far, although more may follow by the end of the year, because they're trying to see what's going to happen with that. Interestingly, though, last week Sinopharm did apply for regulatory approval. So I wonder if the Western vaccines progress has kind of, you know, jolted them into waking up a bit.
It could have done well. It could have encouraged them to speed things up. If the stage three trials are successful, and if it gets a clean bill of health, is the Chinese state on standby with massive stockpiles of this vaccine? I mean, is it ready to roll this out in huge numbers and even to the extent that it might think of exporting or licensing this vaccine around the world?
Absolutely. So as well as China starting emergency vaccination, as I mentioned, UAE has also started giving it approval for emergency vaccination. So Sinopharm is already exporting to the UAE. Countries from Pakistan to Indonesia to Brazil have been striking deals with China to get these vaccines. And the interesting thing about the Chinese vaccines, all three of them, are that they don't need to be in a particularly cold temperature. They don't need to be minus 70. They just need to be at a relatively easier temperature. So for the developing world, because it's going to be A, mass produced by China with its capacity, and also B, because it'll be easier to store, that will be a much more preferable option for poorer countries to deal with than, say, the Oxford vaccine. So in that sense, it is going to go global. Within China, there's a national procurement scheme. And so one public health expert I spoke to said that this might be why companies are so keen to roll out their vaccines now before they get approval, because once they get co-opted into the state scheme, they might not get a say over their prices. So they might as well start cashing in now. But that's just his theory.
All right, Cindy Yu, Spectator's broadcast editor, also the author of our podcast, Chinese Whispers, always worth listening to. Thank you for joining us, Cindy. And that's it for this week. Thanks to our other guests, and once again, to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. Remember, subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, then you'll never miss an episode of Spectator TV, because we'll warn you when one is coming up. You just have to hit the subscribe button at the bottom right-hand corner. It's free. As always, please send any thoughts to Spectator TV at spectator.co.uk. We're always interested in what you have as we strive to be better at this. We're still pretty new at the game. And we hope you'll join us again next Thursday for what will probably be the final The Week in 60 Minutes of 2020. Until then, goodbye.